Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We take your phone calls if you want to make the call. If you have questions to ask and you'd like to bring them up, questions about the Bible or Christianity, the Christian faith or Christian life, if you're on a spiritual journey and just want to talk to somebody about the steps you're taking, the direction you're going, feel free to give me a call. If you have a different view from the host and want to, defend an alternate viewpoint, feel free to do so. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. All right. Our first caller today is Jacob from Tacoma, Washington, who, by the way, called, I think he's the first caller yesterday. We spent about 20 minutes talking yesterday, and then he called my program this morning. We spent some time there, too. And, Jacob, every time you call, I think you have the same question. Do you have a different question today? Welcome.
I hope it's different. I hope I'm not asking the same question over and over.
Well, you have been. You emailed me 9 times today with largely the same question, but go ahead.
I see. Well, maybe this is something that God's given me.
God's given you what?
What I mean is maybe this is something like a passion that God's given me.
Well, passion or not, I'd like you to be clear on your question and ask it one time so we can get to other callers. Our lines are full. Go ahead.
Sure. I'd love to go ahead. I have a question about observing God's commands in light of New Testament scriptures in regard to observing commands found in the Old Testament scriptures. Pertaining to the New Testament scriptures, as New Testament believers, are we to stop at observing of the Old Covenant commands or Old Testament scriptures only those commands that are found reiterated or repeated in the New Testament scriptures? Should we observe all those that are?
Well, the way I understand it is that the commands of the Old Testament that are not any longer relevant are those that have to do with the ceremonial law. The ceremonial law was related to the sacrificial system, the temple, the tabernacle, and things that are no longer relevant to Christianity. They're part of Judaism. Those laws included laws about cleanness and uncleanness, because if you're unclean, you couldn't go to the temple. They had to do with the Levites and the priests. They had to do with holy days and festivals, which included pilgrimages to Jerusalem, to the temple, and things like that. Those are ceremonial laws that have no application beyond the legitimacy of the temple. Now, Jesus, just before he's crucified in Matthew 23, said to the Jews about the temple, your house is left to you desolate. And so he left the temple at that point, never returned. Now, it's interesting because earlier in his ministry, he spoke of the temple and said, my Father's house is supposed to be a house of prayer, but you've made it a den of thieves. Notice he referred at the beginning of his ministry to the temple as his Father's house. At the end of his ministry, he didn't call it his Father's house. He said, it's your house. Your house is left to you desolate. God had left it. Jesus had left it. And with the obsolescence then of the temple and the sacrifices is obviously the obsolescence of all the laws associated with them. Now, Jesus himself never reiterated any of those ceremonial laws. Neither did the New Testament writers. They never urged Christians to keep a ceremonial law. Now, ceremonial law is different than some other aspects in the Law of Moses. The Law of Moses, in addition to being ceremonial, it had rules of how to behave, morally right. And moral righteousness is based on something that never changes. The ceremonies were based on the temple. That changes. The morality is based on God, his own character. The only thing that has ever been moral or immoral has been that which reflects the character of God. And God does not change. And therefore, moral issues, which are found both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, and frankly, in most pagan lands too, many of the same moral issues are known because they have to do with what's basically right and wrong. And they were right and wrong back when Moses gave the law. They were right and wrong before Moses gave the law. They were right and wrong in pagan lands that never had the law. And they're right and wrong in Christianity, where the law is no longer the guide. The guide today is the Spirit of Christ. The Spirit of Christ and our obedience to him dictates our our obedience. We never have to keep a law simply because it's found in the Old Testament, because the Old Testament has passed as the covenant that is relevant to Christians. Christians are under the new covenant. We've said that several times in our conversations. Now, therefore, when we read what Jesus and the apostles commanded us to do, we find that the only things they ever commanded us to do were to do the things that are, in fact, loving toward people and, of course, loving toward God. They did not say that we should do any of the temple rituals. Now, again, Jesus told some Jews who lived under the Old Testament that they should keep the rituals because that's what Jews under the Old Testament were supposed to do. He told the Pharisees, you know, you did pay your tithes of mint and anise and cumin, and you should have done that, he said, but you should not have neglected the weightier matters of the law. Now, in saying that the Pharisees should pay their tithes, Jesus was not saying that we should pay our tithes. He's talking to people who lived under the Old Covenant, and the tithe was part of the law that they were under. The New Testament never reaffirms that law because that's part of the temple system. That's the tithe was to support the workers in the temple, the Levites. That's how they, that was the support of the temple. And Jesus did say that in keeping that law, the Pharisees did what they should have done because they were under that law. Likewise, as I mentioned to you in a previous conversation, Jesus told the lepers to go show themselves to the priest and offer the offerings that that Moses commanded back in Leviticus 13 and 14. Now, these were ceremonial laws to be sure, but these men lived under that law. And likewise, Jesus said to his disciples who were still living under the law when he gave the Sermon on the Mount, when you bring your sacrifice to the altar, if you there remember your brother has something against you, leave your sacrifice and go make peace. In other words, there are times when Jesus, speaking to people who are under the law, reaffirmed to them that the law, as Paul put it in Romans 7, the law is holy and just and good, and those who are under the law are obligated to keep it. And people were under the law until they came to be under Christ in the new covenant. So the new covenant now defines our behavior and our duty. And I realize you're really struggling with that because you keep asking the same question, and I don't really know what it is that's so hard to understand about that. But go ahead and respond.
Okay. I know we don't have a temple right now, so there's obviously commands that we don't observe. Some people believe that's because the temple was destroyed forever. I know there were two temples. Obviously, one was rebuilt.
Well, Jacob, did you listen to me when I spoke? Jacob, when you brought this up this morning on my radio program and I answered this, did you hear what I said?
I actually didn't bring this up. I think you just filled in the blanks.
No. What you brought up was that there are temple rituals that we don't keep because there is no temple and because we can't.
No, I didn't.
Well, okay. Well, that's what I heard you say. And what I said, at least what I said, is a response to what you're saying now. You're saying there are temple laws that we don't keep because there's no temple. I said, no, it's the other way around. There's no temple because we don't need to keep them. If we were supposed to keep temple laws, but simply in the providence of God, we couldn't for the last 2,000 years because the temple's been gone, that would seem very negligent on God's part. But the truth is that God not only providentially allowed the temple to be destroyed, but Jesus predicted that it would be destroyed and that it would be the judgment of God upon it. But why would God judge and destroy the temple if he had not already made all the sacrifices offered there obsolete? So anyway, you know, Jacob, I don't think I'm getting through to you. And I did email you back. I guess you haven't had a chance to read it. I guess what I'd like you to do is decide if you want to refute something I'm saying, that's okay. But you're not doing that. You're just asking the same questions over and over again. So Is there something about my answers that you find unpersuasive?
Well, you do have an answer. It's just we haven't actually discussed the ramifications of what you're saying opposed to what I'm trying to learn.
Well, maybe you could state it clearly enough for me to know what it is you want to talk about. What ramifications?
What I was trying to say was that we obviously don't have a temple. And so we're obviously not doing those things, whether there is going to be a future temple or not. There, God's law as a whole, I mean, everybody is guilty by God's law. We can't say, that God's law has been abolished. You say he didn't come to abolish the law.
So now, you always quote it that way. I'm not sure what translation you're reading. Jesus did not say, I did not come to abolish the law. In Matthew 5:17, the word he used in the Greek is, he said, I did not come to cast down the law, or in many cases it's translated to destroy the law. He did not come to destroy it. And I can't go over this again, because I went over this morning and yesterday too, and apparently there's something I'm saying that's going right past you. And if that's a defect in me, then fine. Maybe I'm just not able to communicate clearly, in which case you should ask somebody else who can communicate clearly. If it's a defect in you that you're not able to hear what I'm saying, well, then that's another argument for maybe talking to somebody that you can understand better. But you're bringing up the same points that we've addressed multiple times, and I'm just not able to give you as much time. You had 20 minutes on the program yesterday, and we talked about many of these same issues, and then you called again this morning. I don't mind you calling, but I don't want any repetition, certainly not twice in 2 days, simply because there's other people waiting. And this morning, on this morning's program, because I did talk to you about these things again, as you'd called yesterday, there were two or three people waiting online who didn't get to go on the program. We ran out of time. There are other people out there. So what I wrote you an email, which you have apparently not read yet. So if you check your inbox, you will. I recommend to you that you actually think about what it is you want me to answer, and then write it out. And if you don't like the way you wrote out, write it out again. Make as many drafts as you want, but don't send me every draft as you did in the email today. Don't send me updated versions of the same paragraph over and over. I just don't have time to read that many paragraphs. I have a lot of things to do, so I'm not trying to be impatient. I'm just saying, if you will think about how you want to ask the question, I will answer as best as I can the question you ask. If I answer the question you ask and you don't like the answer and you decide, well, maybe you didn't answer the question rightly, then let me encourage you not to call again until you know how to ask the question right. Because, I mean, listen, I don't want every show to be dominated with the same question, because I don't want to bore our entire audience with my having to answer the same way every time. Because I have the same answer now as I had yesterday and this morning. I haven't changed my mind, and the answers I gave then are the same answers I would give you now. But we need to give other people a chance to be on the air. I don't mean to make you feel rejection or anything like that, but there are other people. And, let's face it, there's lots of different questions. We don't need to dominate the show with one question every program. Okay. Oscar from Riverside, California is one of the callers, I think, who tried to get on this morning and didn't have time. Oscar, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes. I want to talk about tattoos.
Okay.
Okay. I'm 59 years old. So I grew up back in the 70s where people were having tattoos, not as much as right now. But I grew up, what I want you to take me back to the Old Testament, was that the same type of ink that it couldn't be erased that they were using back then?
Well, I honestly don't know what technology they had for tattoos back then. I assume that a tattoo has always referred to a rather permanent mark, but I may be wrong. Maybe just making any kind of marks on the body, including the kind that you could wash off, were included in what the Bible was asking them not to do. I don't know enough about it. Frankly, the Bible only mentions tattoos one time in Leviticus, and it does not explain whether the word tattoo at that time was in every respect the same as what we call a tattoo today, certainly a mark on the skin. However, we do find in the book of Revelation, chapter 14, verse 1, the 144,000 have the master's name written on their forehead. Is this supposed to look like a tattoo or what? I don't know. It obviously is not something bad, although I don't think it's literal either. I don't think it's a literal tattoo, but I think that the fact that the godly people are represented, symbolically at least, as if they do have a tattoo on their forehead of God's name, suggests that, whatever they had as in the way of tattoos were not entirely objectionable.
Okay. Can I ask you another question?
Sure.
I can?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Yeah, the Church of Christ, that they don't use instruments. Do you think they're like, something's not right with that?
Well, I disagree with the Church of Christ in they're not thinking that there should be used instruments in the church. I agree with some of the sentiment, but biblically I don't think they have a case. The use of instruments in the church is seemingly condoned in the Bible itself. First of all, there were a lot of psalms, which were the songbooks that the Christians used and which the Jews used. And the psalms, the word psalm or psalmos in the Greek means a song to be accompanied by a stringed instrument. Okay, that's what the word psalm itself means in the Greek language. And many of the psalms actually advocate the use of musical instruments. In fact, outside the psalms, in the books of Kings, there was a time when a king called for Elisha, the prophet, to come prophesy, and the prophet said, bring a musician here. And a musician came and started playing some music on an instrument, and the Spirit of God came on the prophet as the music came. Likewise, David, in playing his harp, seemed to drive demons away from Saul. So it seems clear that musical instruments in the Old Testament were used for the worship of God, were used even to bring about a spiritual state of mind to the prophet and to drive away demons from Saul. So I don't know how anyone could take a negative view of musical instruments from that. Now, when you come to the New Testament, there are three times where the New Testament tells us to sing the Psalms. And we're told that in Colossians, I think it's 3:15, in Ephesians chapter 4, and also in James.
Yeah.
It says that we should speak to ourselves in psalms and hymns, or James said, is any merry, let him sing the Psalms. Now, the word Psalms, as I mentioned, is a song to be accompanied by musical instruments, by stringed instruments. And so, in other words, the New Testament does not give any evidence that the New Testament church has a different attitude toward musical instruments, a more negative one, than the Jews had. The Jews had a very positive attitude based on the Psalms and the prophets and so forth, but some people may think that the church in the New Testament has a different attitude toward them. We don't find it to be so in the New Testament. There's certainly nothing in the New Testament that speaks negatively of musical instruments. And as I said, there are three places in the letters that tell us to employ the Psalms, which many of them actually, you know, urge us to use musical instruments. Now, when John is caught up into heaven in his visions, although I'm pretty sure what he saw was symbolic, he did see people playing harps and worshiping God that way. So, you know, in other words, you don't find any part of the Bible that speaks negatively about musical instruments. And you do find the normativeness of their use in Jewish worship and in heaven and presumably in Christian worship where the New Testament tells us to use the Psalms.
So how is it going to work, like the Catholics that, you know, they embraced Mary, Jesus Christ, that, you know, have this teaching? When we all died and get up there in heaven, there was just the wrong teaching?
Well, yeah. I mean, let's face it, a lot of everyone's wrong about something, right? I mean, there's nobody who – there may be people who think they're right about everything, but there aren't any. There's nobody who's omniscient. Paul himself said, we know in part. He included himself in that. He was an apostle who had been caught up in the third heaven and had seen and heard things no one could utter. Yet he still included himself as one who didn't know everything. So that means that if we don't know everything, there's some things where we have yet to learn. There's things where we would be wrong about.
Yeah.
So, you know, everybody who goes to heaven is going to be wrong about some things, but there's, to my mind, it'd be absurd to suggest that God's going to let people go to heaven or not let people go to heaven based on honest mistakes that they made just because they didn't know everything. Nobody then would qualify for heaven. So, I mean, I don't really see that keeping musical instruments out of the church, I don't see that as a biblical practice. But the churches that do it are not doing something horrible. They're not doing something sinful. I just, in fact, last week, about this time last week, I was at Pepperdine University to hear N.T. Wright speaking. And that's a Church of Christ institution. And they had nine people up there leading the worship vocally without instruments. And, you know, 1,000 or more people singing. And it was beautiful. It's beautiful to hear the music, the singing without the instruments. And I've been to other Church of Christ functions where they did that, too. Usually people who are in the Church of Christ, because they don't have musical instruments, really do put a lot into their singing. You know, singing in four parts and things like that. It's all very, the human voice is a very beautiful instrument, the most beautiful of all instruments, probably.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is there's no tragedy that the Church of Christ doesn't allow instruments.
Yeah.
They don't take a hit. They don't diminish anything in terms of the quality of the music that they have in their church. So that's not a problem to me if they don't have musical instruments. But if somebody says, well, if your church has musical instruments, then you're ungodly. And there have been Church of Christ people in the past who have thought that, although most modern Church of Christ people don't seem to have quite that legalistic attitude. But if they say that, you know, it's a sin or something to have instruments in the church, that's sheer legalism. There's not a single verse of Scripture that will support what they're saying.
Yeah. And, you know, when they sing a cappella, they're hitting a chord, too, like a guitar.
Well, yeah, but yeah, exactly. Well, the interesting thing is I have some friends who, I have a friend who's a leader in Church of Christ in the Midwest, and they had me come and speak at a conference there one weekend, and he and some other members of the church were the song leaders. And they, in typical Church of Christ fashion, they sang in four parts, but more than that, they had one guy doing a beatbox with his mouth and another guy with his mouth doing what sounded like a bass guitar.
Yeah.
So... Now, they didn't have any real instruments, just human voices up there, but when you were listening, it sounded like there was a drummer and a bass guitar playing, as well as, you know, four-part harmonies.
That's talent.
That's very talented. They're very talented, and we loved it. My wife and I, we thought that was very beautiful.
Yeah.
Very beautiful. We thought it was rather strange that they would be against musical instruments, and then they would, imitate them.
I've been saying that for years.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, every group has blind spots. I think that's possibly a blind spot. It certainly is a cultural thing. People who are raised in the Church of Christ without instruments probably have come to really love the sound of a cappella music. And
Yeah. Sometimes
what you've become accustomed to culturally, especially in the church, it begins to take on in your heart the sense of an obligation before God, because you associate it with your worshiping God. You associate it with the church. And yet I have some really good friends who are Church of Christ people. One of them, the one who took me to Pepperdine this last week, he goes to a church where they don't use musical instruments, but he comes to my meetings where we play guitars and stuff. He doesn't care.
Yeah.
And there's lots of Church of Christ people like that. They just, you know, they go to a non-instrumental church, but it's not an issue to them. And then there's, of course, I should mention this because if I don't, someone will call and do so. There's also the instrumental Church of Christ. There's the Church of Christ exists in different branches, and one branch would restrict music to being only a cappella, and the other allows musical instruments.
Yeah, I think I know. I heard that. There's two of them, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Greg. Thank you very much.
All right. Good talking to you, Oscar. Yeah, don't judge them too much for not using instruments. I think they're doing fine. The only problem is if they judge you, if you do use musical instruments. That's where it becomes a problem. All right. Norma from Portland, Oregon is our next caller. And we have a line open for you at this number, 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Norma, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. Hey, it just seems like every time the subject Israel comes up on this program that, I don't know, I feel like you have a negative feeling toward them, and you think the conflicts are kind of their fault, and I see it so different. We went to see that movie, Jerusalem. It's at the Evergreen Theater on the way to the beach. And it's not a Christian film. It just shows how Jerusalem is divided into four parts. The Jews have one section. And when that land was given to them, there was no borders set up. Our president at that time, Neil, my husband was telling me the history of this, encouraged England, who I believe it was part of Great Britain's empire. It really wasn't. It really didn't belong to the Arabs. And the Arabs lived there, a lot of them. There were some Jews that lived there. They were nomads, the Arabs.
Well,
were.
Let me clarify that, because you maybe haven't heard the whole story. The Arabs lived there for 1,300 years.
Yeah.
The Palestinians who live in Israel today, their ancestors have lived in that land for 1,300 years. It was not part of the British Empire. What it was part of the Turkish Empire at one time, but the Arabs lived there anyway. Under the Ottoman Turks, for several hundred years, I think about 400 years or more, the Ottoman Turks controlled that region, and they permitted Arabs, you know, to live there because they had lived there before the Turks were there. They had no reason to drive them all out. So the Arab Palestinians lived there for hundreds of years under the Turks. That was until World War One. In World War One, the British and the Allies conquered the Ottoman Turks because the Turks had aligned with Hitler, and therefore, you know, our allies conquered Hitler's allies in the world. It was Germany at the time, or Prussia at the time, but it was not Hitler, of course. It was our enemies nonetheless. The Turks were aligned with our enemies, with Prussia, and they were defeated by the British. And no, I take that back. It was World War II. I'm sorry. I'm mistaken, I think. I believe it was World War II. Now I'm getting my dates mixed up. Because, of course, those wars happened within a few decades of each other. It's kind of easy to mix them up. In any case, I believe it was after World War II that the British were given the mandate by the League of Nations to kind of watch over that region, to kind of govern it. It wasn't part of the British Empire. It was just a region that had been conquered from our enemies during the war, and Britain was given the responsibility for overseeing it. And
our president was for letting the Jews go back to that area.
Yeah.
And I've always thought everything I've ever heard, if there was a fight or a war, I know the Jews didn't have much land, there were no borders, and they went, the Six-Day War was, most people feel it was a miracle of God that they won back some of the land. But anyhow, the Palestinians, when they were refugees because of some of this, not one Arab country would let them back into their land. Because I feel like deep down underneath, the Arabs want there to be conflict. They want people to hate the Jews. They want everybody to think it's all the Jews' fault. And they wouldn't let any of their people come back into their countries. They
Norma,
wouldn't let them.
Norma, we wouldn't let the Jews come to our country after a while either in
know,
World
we,
War II.
We allowed so many. We couldn't absorb them all.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me put it this way. The issues over Palestine are not really affected by how the surrounding Arab nations treated the Palestinians. The issue is the Palestinians were there. That was their land.
There were Jewish people there, too.
Yes,
and
there were.
They gave places for the Palestinians to live, but they didn't want to be confined to an area. They wanted.
They didn't like being in refugee camps very much. They still don't. Norma.
They didn't let them come back into their countries either.
Norma, if you'd like to know more about this, you can either do research on it from both sides, and there are books out there that written by people sympathetic to the Palestinians, including Elizabeth Elliot, who went over there in the 60s favorable toward Israel and came back favorable toward the Palestinians once she had talked to everybody and learned the history there. That happens a lot. Christians here in America, we hear an awful lot of things about, you know, Israel being the victim. And then when you go over there and meet the people and see even how the Palestinians are still treated, some people come back saying, well, it's not all that easy. It's not really necessarily the case that Israel's the victims. They are the victims of some things, and the Palestinians are victims of some things. The real question is, how much have most American Christians bothered to learn about that conflict? Very little. And what they hear from their churches, which are usually dispensational, like your church. And so I would suggest that you get a hold of some material that tells both sides of the story. If you're interested, I have a lecture where I do that.
How come Obama wouldn't talk to Netanyahu when he came here? I believe he came here three times. The last time he was forced to talk to him because of public...
Well, I'm not defending whatever. Obama. I'm not anti-Israel, and I'm not pro-Obama. I mean, I think Obama is, well, the words I have to use for him are very negative. I wouldn't say them on the air probably. But the truth is, what Obama did to Netanyahu is not even related to the question of the origins of the state of Israel.
Our country doesn't take up a side anyway. If Israel has no friends whatsoever, I just feel that that's of the devil, and I think God will not bless our country if we turn our back on Israel.
Well, I think friendship and trust and things like that are things that need to be earned, and I think we should be friendly toward nations that are showing themselves to be operating under justice and good principles that we can approve of. If Israel does that, then we should be their friend. If they don't do that, then maybe we should find better friends. But that's...
Well, I think they've always been our friend, and anyway, I don't want to talk any more about it. I feel the way I feel, and it's kind of hard to hear the other side sometimes.
Well, I notice that when you call sometimes, but you know, let me just say this. If you're interested, you can go to my website, thenarrowpath.com. I don't think you will, Norma, but if you're interested, you can. Go to thenarrowpath.com and go to the tab that says Topical Lectures. And there you will find, among the various topical series, there's a series called What Are We to Make of Israel? And if you look at that series, What Are We to Make of Israel?, almost all the lectures are simply Bible studies on the subject of Israel. But one lecture is called The Modern State of Israel. And I do give the history of it there. And it's a history that most Christians do not know about. And there's a pretty good book that came out a few years ago, called If Americans Knew. I don't have it in front of me. I don't remember the author's name, but it's a pretty good detailed story of the Israeli and Palestinian conflict. It's a secular book. It's not a Christian book. It's called If Americans Knew, and it's very, very documented. And my lecture is also somewhat documented, but I don't have enough time in a lecture to give all the documentation that a book could give. So, I mean, it is possible to hear both sides if someone wishes to know the truth. If somebody really is uncomfortable hearing the other side, like you were saying, then fine. I mean, you don't have to hear the other side if you don't care about the truth. But if you do care about truth, you should always hear both sides of a controversy, not just this one, any controversy. And that's why I try as much as I can to expose my listeners to both sides of different controversial issues. Because if you love truth, you're going to want to make sure that the view you've heard and that you think you can defend is not overlooking important things that someone else knows but you're not listening to. So I really just want the truth. I'm not against Israel. In fact, I spent my whole life pro-Israel. I have learned some things in the research I've done the past couple of years that have surprised me and have definitely moderated my position. But those are some resources that are out there available. Let's talk next to Bob from Portland, Oregon. Bob, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I originally called because I wanted to maybe challenge some of our views on Levitican law, but I kind of want to chime in on the Israel thing.
Okay.
If you don't mind. Just relay some anecdotal stuff. I have a friend who's in his mid-70s. He's a Syrian immigrant from an ancient Christian family. And in talking to him, the persecution of Christians by Jews and Muslims in that region are pretty huge. And probably want to just state that it's more important that we relate at a personal level than on a national level.
I agree completely. Yeah. Yeah, we need to deal with people not on the basis of their ethnicity nor on the basis of their nationality. We need to deal with people on the basis of their own merits.
Yes, and we can take that example from Jesus, who related person by person.
That's right.
Have you ever read the book Prophetic Imagination by Walter Brueggemann?
Walter Brueggemann. That's the second time today I've heard his name. I have a book by him, but not on that. No, I've not heard of that book.
Brueggemann has some pretty interesting thoughts related to how we see the Old Testament. And I'm sorry you haven't read it, because I want to kind of take that hermeneutic on Levitical law and say, I've been working on, in my own spiritual journey, looking at how I view grace and seeing that God makes allowance for us in many different ways. He didn't execute Cain. He let Cain go and even said he'd protect him. He told Samuel that he really didn't think they needed a king, and Samuel says, but they want one. So he says, okay, they can have a king. We don't see any codification of the law until we get to the Exodus. And, yeah, I want to just throw out and see what you think. There is the Levitical law, and when we read the text, it says, the Lord said, do this. But I want to maybe put in our heads that it was Israel that asked for the law, not God who commanded that law exist. And so God said, well, if you're going to do it this way.
You know, somebody I know has, I've read that suggestion at our Bible forum before, but I can't pinpoint any time when God asked, or when the people asked God for the law.
I think it's absent in the text, and so I'm working on it as a supposition, not as an absolute. But it brings us in our Christian life to some interesting statements that are tough for me to reconcile. Teachers that say the reason that you need Jesus is because you can't keep all those laws. And I keep coming back and saying, well, but God said, love me with your whole heart in the Old Testament. And coincidentally, he says, love me with your whole heart in the New Testament. So if there's any congruity, it's simply in that one commandment that says, I just need all of you.
Okay.
And when we go back to the patriarchs and match up Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, throw Joseph in for a bonus, and then we go to Hebrews chapter 11, we don't see that they had any codification of the law. They simply related to their God with their whole hearts. So when we look at Levitical law, and again, in a suppositive fashion, we don't need to argue, yes, there's a temple, no, there's a temple. In fact, let me backtrack a little bit. There's even a possibility, as I process this through, that God allowed for the temple simply because Solomon needed a temple for his God, because he was building temples for everybody else.
Well, true about the temple. Yeah, God never did demand that a temple be built, though he did command that the tabernacle be built.
He did, yes, and I think there was a need for the tabernacle and its symbolism. But even Paul says, I'm going to bounce around a little bit here, I'm sorry. Even Paul says, related to the ark, that the ark is in your heart. So much of the Old Testament...
Wait, where does it say that?
Man, I'm sorry. I'm in the car, and so
I've never read a passage in the Bible that says the ark is in your heart.
Yeah, it's the memory of the things that are in the heart ark that are important, not the ark itself.
I mean, these are kind of abstract ideas. Could you maybe summarize your point into a sentence or two, so I'll know where you're going with
absolutely.
This?
Absolutely, absolutely. We read the Old Testament and we assign to God that certain things happen because he demanded them. There are many places in the Old Testament where the people demanded things and God acquiesced. And so I'm just throwing out there that where we have difficulty reconciling Levitical law to what we think, It may be because the people said, we need codification, where God said, I don't need to do that, but here, let me show you how. Let me show you how to make a sacrifice. Let me show you what to do with skin disease. Let me show you this. Let me show you that. And all of that, I would agree, points to Christ, but wasn't necessary.
Well, I guess you're making an assumption that seems like a very, very large one. In fact, it changes the whole Bible, and yet you say you're doing it by supposition, that it was the people who asked for the law, and God kind of maybe, you know, just as a concession gave them the law. If that were true, then you wouldn't think God would care very much about the law, because it wasn't his idea anyway. Yet the Bible indicates that God cared a great deal about them keeping the law in the Old Testament. And Jesus actually said that Moses, through God, actually, here's what it says in Matthew 15:4. Jesus said, for God commanded, saying, honor your father and your mother, and he who curses father or mother, let him be put to death.
True.
Now, God commanded that. Now, it sounds like that. Yes. Well, the first part's in the Decalogue. The other part is in what's called the Book of the Covenant later on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's two commands there. One is in the Decalogue, honor your father and mother. The other one, he who curses father and mother, let him be put to death, is not in the Decalogue. That's actually taken from Exodus 21:17.
Yeah.
But the point here is that Jesus indicated, of course, what the Jews believed. First of all, that God is the one who gave them that law. And he commanded it, and apparently it was important enough to God that he had affixed a death penalty to it. Certainly the impression I get reading both the Old and the New Testament is that the law was God's idea, not people's idea. And what's that?
No, finish your thought. Go ahead.
Well, and you mentioned the one reason that it may go against the way we think is because it was really man's idea or something like that, or I'm not sure exactly how you said that. I think it goes against the way we think because our hearts are not. I think we need to be renewed in our mind to recognize the things that God was thinking.
My favorite verse in the Bible. However, to be contrary to what you quoted related to father and mother, and I believe that wholeheartedly. He also comes back and says, "I want your obedience, not your sacrifices." Yet the whole sacrificial system was in place and seemed to have huge weight in that culture, and for reason.
What you're quoting somewhat from Samuel, 1 Samuel 15:22, where God said, "Has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings as in heeding the word of the Lord?" He says, "Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice." Now, he's not saying that sacrifices are not to be done. He's saying that obeying God is more important than sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And so also, it says in in Hosea 6:6, it says, I will have mercy rather than sacrifice. But at the same time, this is simply saying that God prioritizes different laws that were merely ceremonial like sacrifice, were not as important as moral laws, like to be merciful to people or to be obedient to God. And also, you know, Jesus mentioned that David broke the law of the showbread and was seemingly guiltless for that. So, I mean, there definitely are laws in the Old Testament that would trump other laws if they came into conflict with each other. Anyway, I guess you've had a chance to share what you wanted to say. I appreciate you calling. We're going to take some more calls here. Let's talk to Ken from the Bay Area, California. Ken, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Interesting conversation you were having there. I believe it can all be summed up in just one word. It's all about righteousness. That's how I sum up the whole thing. I had both a question and a comment. The question that I had has to do with 1 Samuel, where the ark had been taken by the Philistines, and they had taken it to Ashdod and to Gath and to Ekron. And it says in my Bible that all the curses that came upon the people and the people dying in those communities, and it says that it turned on their emerods, and the Imurads attack their private parts and so forth. And I'm not familiar with that term, Imurads, so I wondered if you could clarify for that for me.
Well, Imurads is an old English word that's found, as far as I know, only in the King James Version.
That's what I heard. Yeah,
most translations give it the modern term hemorrhoids.
Oh, okay. Well, that explains that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that explains that. I use the I prefer the the King James Version. Now, the other comment that I had to make, you were talking about tithing earlier, and I agree with with everything you said on tithing. There is a thing which has to do with seed giving, and I've heard some of the proponents of this that are very articulate on the matter, and at first I bitterly disagreed with it, and I thought it was a fraud, and my son listened to it, and he believed it, and he went and sent a large amount on a seed offering, and this is what happened. He had a real problem with his work and so forth. Within about a week and a half, several different people came around. People knocked on the door because he did work on cars and so forth and body work. One after another showed up wanting to do work. And within a period, just a couple of weeks, he had more work than he knew what he could do. And then I saw something similar to that happen a couple of other times. In my own case, I've been giving. I support three or four different ministries, and I don't think too much about the return on it because I believe in supporting the work of the Lord. But it seems like there is a certain amount of blessings that come back forth from that, which I'm not actually able to measure. But I have heard one of the major proponents of this, who seems to be able to answer every question, point out, he says, when you give something to God, he says, what you can't see, or what you can see in your hand, when you release what you can see in your hand, God releases what you can't see in his hand. And he's given a lot of different examples of that, and you probably know who I'm talking about.
And like well, I know that...
A lot of us out there disagree with that concept.
Oral Roberts was the first person I ever heard talk about the seed faith giving, but I think others have picked up on it. He's one of the older voices. There's probably younger guys who are making that case now, but I don't listen to them. But well, the seed faith idea is that if you need money, give some away, and God will bless that and send you more. And it's an act of faith on your part, because obviously if you need money, you don't feel like you can afford to give any away, but do it anyway, trusting that God will provide for you. Now, I don't have any doubt that God sometimes will bless people who make that kind of a step, but I don't think necessarily that we can make that as a universal promise. That would mean, I mean, what these people are encouraging people to do is to usually send them money, and then get a profit off of it. I don't really think that money should be given to God with the mind of getting profit from it, or else how is that really generosity? You mentioned that you give without thinking about return, and so do I. I never think about return when I give, and yet God does provide. I mean, God definitely provides all my needs and above my needs. So, you know, I don't have any problem with the fact that God will often bless you because you were generous or because you showed faith in him by giving to someone in need more than you, perhaps. And then he makes it up to you. I don't believe you can outgive God, as sort of like preachers have said, you can't outgive God. On the other hand, I don't think we should be making promises to people that would motivate them to say, wow, I need some money, I think I'll give some away. That kind of ruins the giving. If you're doing it in order to get something back for yourself, Jesus said, give, expecting nothing in return, and you will be blessed. He said that in Luke 6. So I would never teach a seed faith giving doctrine, because the truth is that although God may choose to bless you because you were generous, he may also choose to test you further. He may have blessed your son for being generous and sent him more work, and that's what I would hope God would do when people are trusting him anyway. But, you know, there may be a time when, although he wants you to give something, he doesn't want to, you know, send back more right away because you're going to be tested in your faith or in your finances or something. I mean, there are trials that Christians are supposed to go through. It's part of the Christian life. Anyway, I would never want to teach anyone to do anything with the mind of getting money back for it, because that's, I mean, in terms of Christian conduct, because obviously Christianity is not supposed to be about me. It's supposed to be about me serving God and blessing others. I appreciate your call. Let's talk to Lisa from Hillsboro, Oregon next. Lisa, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have I heard on the radio from a preacher that that everything that happens to you gets filtered by God first. Can you hear me?
If you're trusting God for your safety, if you're trusting God as your master and Lord in everything, then I believe that He protects you from things He doesn't want to happen to you. And that means if things do happen to you, it's because He let them happen. And that's what I guess I would understand filtering to mean. Job is an example of a man who is trusting God, and the devil was not able to do anything to him. That devil complained and said, God, you've put a hedge around him. I can't touch him. And yet, when it came time for Job to be tested, God allowed the devil to get through that hedge, but strictly restricted how much the devil could do. So we can see, you know, the things happening to Job were definitely filtered, if you want to use that term, by God, because God promises His protection to His people. Jesus said, not a sparrow falls to the ground apart from the will of your Father, and you're worth more than many sparrows. Now, that makes it sound like not even bad things happen to birds, except what have been filtered through God's permission. Only by the will of God does a sparrow even die. And they're just a brute beast, an animal. And so for His children, certainly, God, as Jesus said, pays much closer attention to us, and it cares much more about us. So anything that happens to you, you have to realize that if God had wished, He could have prevented it. He's got the angel of the Lord encamping about those who fear Him, who can certainly defend them from anything if He wants them to. Remember, Jesus said, if I wished, I could call 12 legions of angels, and they would come deliver me from the things that were happening to Him. But Jesus knew very well that it wasn't the Father's will for Him to be delivered from them, and that these things were going to happen to Him because the Father was allowing them to happen. He could send angels to protect Him, but that was not the right thing to do at that time. Jesus was going to suffer. It was necessary, and there's times when we suffer according to the will of God too. But we commit the keeping of our souls to God in well-doing as unto a faithful Creator, Peter says in 1 Peter 4:19. So, I think everything that happens to me when I'm trusting God is filtered through God's sovereign will, and that He, you know, if harm comes to me, it is only because God permitted it, and that's a good thing to know, because that means, because God is a loving God, He would never permit anything that He doesn't intend to use for my good. That means the harm that comes to me is not just random and senseless. It means that it's part of God's fatherly dealing with me. And that's always good to know if you trust God to be a good father. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are listener-supported. If we do pay a lot of money to stay on the air, if you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can always donate from the website if you want to, and everything at the website is free. The website is thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.